mis amigos lograron.
My friends were able to escape, and they caught me, and they began to hit me. They were punishing me. They were cutting my hands.
Me estaban cortando las manos.
This is a story of escape.
In the town where I live, there is a lot of crime, and there is a gang there that is, like, bad. And they're looking for people in order to grow in size and, as they say, expand their territory.
18-year-old Melvin grew up in a mountain town in Guatemala where violent gangs were a daily reality, and one he was always aware of. Then one day, a year ago, in the fall of 2017, Melvin found himself face-to-face with a local gang's brutality.
They began talking with me, and they said, "Hey, man, you know, we need more people in our gang. Do you want to join our gang? Would you like that?" And I said, "No." I said, "No, I did not want to. I wasn't going to leave my studies for things that weren't good." Then, after some time, they got tired, and I think on the 12th or 14th of September, they beat me. Between all of them, they beat me because I didn't want to tell them yes. They thought I would fight back, but then they all began piling on and began beating me. I think I bled from here, with punches all over here.
The gang tortured Melvin, using knives to slice slowly and painfully into his arms. With the support of his parents, he fled to the U.S. seeking safety. Alone, Melvin set out on the dangerous journey to the border on the infamous cargo train known as the Beast. But once he made it to Arizona, his battles had only just begun. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, the story of unaccompanied minors fleeing to the United States and what happens once they arrive. We've been talking a lot in this country about the children separated at the border under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, as we should be, and we will continue those conversations. But those children represent a small segment of the minors crossing the border to come to the United States. Young people like Melvin come to the U.S. by the thousands each month on their own, fleeing horrific situations in their home countries and finding a new set of challenges when they arrive here in search of asylum. In the not-too-distant past, a young man like Melvin would have had a narrow shot at asylum given the violence he was looking to escape and the physical evidence on his body of the cruelty he faced in Guatemala. But in the last few years under the Trump administration, the asylum process has gotten more complicated. With us now is Beth Fertig, a senior reporter covering immigration, courts, and legal affairs at WNYC. Beth, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
So let's start off, because this is such a complicated story, I think, for a lot of Americans. When we say unaccompanied minors in the United States, what do we mean?
Unaccompanied minors, or as they're known by the government, unaccompanied alien children, are kids who cross the border without a parent. More than half of them are over the age of 15. They're mostly from the triangle countries of Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, places that are very dangerous and also very poor. And they will come by themselves, or maybe with friends or other relatives who are not their parents, come to the U.S. border. And sometimes they sneak in, but very often they go to a border agent and say, I'm seeking asylum. I want to stay here. And then after they are sent to stay with a sponsor, another relative who's staying in the U.S., they will go to immigration court and have their case heard by a judge.
Prior to the Trump administration, tell us a little bit about what that process was like.
So in the past, it was never easy to win asylum from the immigration lawyers I've spoken to. But this past spring, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who controls the immigration courts, they're an arm of the U.S. Justice Department, he ruled on a case about a woman fleeing domestic abuse in Central America. And he said that people who are fleeing gang violence and domestic abuse, they're fleeing criminals who are private criminal actors. They're not part of the government. It's not like the government was beating the woman or the government was committing violence on these teens who are trying to be recruited into gangs. So he said those are private criminal actors, and it makes it much tougher. His orders to the immigration judges were, it's very tough right now to grant asylum. In the past, however, the judges would have some discretion. They could say, well, you know, I think in this particular case, I'm going to side with the kid's lawyer. And what's happening now is there is no guaranteed right to a lawyer in immigration court for anybody. But it's especially difficult for children because they're children. They don't know the law. They don't have an adult coming with them. And so there's been an effort over the years to provide lawyers for the children. But in the past year, it's the number of kids who are represented goes down. If you don't have a lawyer, you're virtually never going to get your case heard. Last year, fiscal year 2017, only about 40% of the kids got lawyers. And what's happened is the lawyers are saying that they are so busy now with Trump's immigration policies, their cases are taking longer, it's harder to get new clients. And Tanzino, there's also a weird quirk in the New York City Immigration Court where they used to have a room for the lawyers to meet with the kids on certain days when the kids would come to court and there'd be three judges assigned to hear their cases. And now that room was taken away because they needed to turn it into another courtroom. So the kids come to court, and this is how I met Melvin. They come to court by themselves. There's nobody to meet them and say, here's how to get a lawyer. There's just some lawyers passing out flyers in the hallway. And Melvin is by himself, completely afraid, thinking he's going to get deported that day, when that's not actually what's going to happen. He's just appearing, and the judge is asking, do you have a lawyer? He didn't have a lawyer. He was told, okay, you have three more months, come back. Hopefully you'll have a lawyer then. And he leaves terrified, thinking, what am I going to do? I have to find a lawyer.
So if a minor does not have, say, a sponsor or a family that's waiting to take them in, they can't find a lawyer, what happens?
It's very difficult. Melvin was lucky because he came in the beginning of the year. He was released to an uncle who lives in Bushwick. But if he had come later this year, the Trump administration made it harder for the sponsor, the relative, to take the child by adding a stricter background check with fingerprinting that would also inform immigration of that sponsor's status. So Melvin's uncle is undocumented. A lot of the kids who are coming now are staying longer and longer in the shelters where they're placed when they first cross the border, like Melvin. He only stayed for about a month in Arizona. Then he was placed with his uncle. But these days, the kids are staying several months. The shelters are backlogged now with kids, and that's why they're moving some of the kids to a tent city in Texas, where they don't have the same rights to an education every day that they would in a normal shelter that's contracted with the federal government and has to meet certain standards. They can stay in this tent city in kind of harsher conditions. They're trying to pick, I've heard, the kids who are ready to be placed with sponsors very soon, so they're not little ones who are going to be hanging out for a long time, but it's still a difficult situation, and it's because of this bottleneck right now that the background checks have made it harder to place the children.
Given that bottleneck and given these delays, are there concerns about what could happen to these kids when they're in this limbo? Are they more susceptible to running away? Are they more susceptible to mental health issues because
Absolutely.
They're sort of caught in this limbo? Like, what happens when this is now extended, this time period where they're staying in this limbo is extended to these kids?
Well, first, these kids are in trauma if they are fleeing violence. And even if they're not, it's a pretty dramatic journey to come to the U.S. In Melvin's case, he rode the Beast, which is this series of cargo trains that kids and other migrants jump on top of and ride for days. It's very, very dangerous. And he was actually robbed at the end of it before he got to the border. Some bandits took money from him. But it's a tough experience getting to the U.S. Then you're staying in this kind of limbo for a while without somebody who loves you. It's an agonizing wait. And the longer you drag it out, child experts in trauma and child psychology say it just makes it much, much more difficult for these kids to become more resilient when they come out. They don't feel the love and support of somebody. They've been living in limbo. They don't know their future. These are young minds that are still developing. Many of the kids, remember, are younger than teenagers. So it's not a situation that you want to prolong. On the other hand, the government says we're doing these background checks because sometimes the kids get placed with traffickers. That has happened. There have been cases where the government doesn't really do a good job of checking who the kids went to in the past, and they wound up going to people who could take advantage of them and exploit them. So you do want to make sure that they're going to someplace safe, but to delay it this long is what immigration advocates are saying is very dangerous for the children.
And can you give us an update on where he is now?
Yeah. First of all, he's very typical. So he's in some ways, and I don't want to be glib about this, he is just like thousands of other kids, okay? But he's not. He's his own person with his own story of being threatened, of being cut on the arm by people who tried to recruit him to join a gang to sell drugs and to kill people. And that was very, very scary for him. And his family said, you have to leave, because they prey on teenage boys. And if he had known more about the process, for example, he could have photographed his wounds when he was in Guatemala. He could have gone to a doctor, although he said there was no hospital in his town. He could have maybe gotten some affidavits or something from people to say what had happened. But he just came. He didn't know what to do. And so now his story is suspect. It's just a story. He still has the scars. He's going to have to, now that he has a lawyer, he's going to meet with a trauma expert, a clinical social worker, to kind of piece together his story, because it's a little bit fragmented. You know, it's hard. He's very reserved, and it's tough. It's going to be a few years probably before his case goes to court. And ironically, because the courts are so backlogged, it could hurt Melvin's case that it's taking so long, but it could also help him if there's another president at the end of this with different immigration policies. So we don't know what's going to happen. But in the meantime, he's working at a pizzeria to pay for his lawyer. He's not supposed to work until he gets working papers, which you do after you file for asylum. But he has to pay for his rent. He has to pay for his lawyer. And this kid works 6 days a week. And he's a very industrious kid. He'd like to learn English. He doesn't have the time to take classes. He could conceivably enroll in high school, but he doesn't have the time because he wants to pay and he wants to do the right thing and go to court.
Beth Fertig is a senior reporter at WNYC. Beth, thanks so much for helping us with this story.
Thank you for having me.
There are new details today in the mysterious disappearance of Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi, a U.S. resident, went missing earlier this month in Turkey. Now, a Turkish official tells the New York Times that he was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on orders of the highest levels of the Saudi government. With me on the line is Carlotta Gall, the Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. Carlotta, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Can you remind our listeners who Khashoggi is and why he was being targeted by the Saudi government?
So he was one of the most outspoken critics, but the most interesting thing for a lot of us who knew him over the years was that he was well connected to the government. He had served in the government. He became a spokesman for some senior officials. So for us, we knew him that way. And then lately he'd taken up a post with the Washington Post as a global columnist and moved away from Saudi Arabia and basically set up in self-imposed exile. And his criticism had increased. So he was a real thorn in their side, as we see clearly now with his fate.
And you've been speaking to sources within the Turkish government, Carlotta. What are the new developments here?
So we've been following this day by day, and drip by drip, the information has come out. It was clear from the start, though, that the Turkish officials here were very alarmed, and they talked early on of his possible death. And now we are getting the actual evidence. We don't have his body yet, but we've got very firm signs from Turkish officials. They don't want to come out in public, but they're clearly giving it to journalists to publish that there was two groups of Saudis that arrived on the day that he attended a meeting at the consulate. He never came out from that meeting on October the 2nd, over a week ago, and these officials that flew in on private planes and left the same day.
These were Saudi officials or Turkish officials?
Saudi officials, 15 of them on two separate planes. They came in at different times that day, and they left the same day. And the Turkish officials are saying they were essentially a hit squad. They were responsible for killing him, dismembering his body, and somehow disposing of it. So the mystery remains. The investigation, the Turks have now mounted an investigation. They're asking for access to the consulate, which of course is diplomatic territory. So that's also unprecedented, but they're taking it very seriously.
There are some very lurid details in your story in the New York Times. Can you tell us a little bit about what we know so far about how Khashoggi was killed, if that's in fact what happened?
The details are gruesome. As one official told my colleague David Kirkpatrick, that it's something like Pulp Fiction, and that they even arrived with a bone saw among their equipment. We know they took several boxes and suitcases out of the embassy, of the consulate building, put them in vehicles. We know they traveled with luggage on their private planes. So it's coming out slowly, but there's some very alarming details. There is even one team to do the job of killing him and another team to clean up the premises afterwards.
Now, what do we know about how the United States has reacted, if at all? The United States obviously has close ties to the Saudis. Has there been anything from the U.S. so far?
So at first, it was a bit muted. I think perhaps for everyone, nobody was quite sure what had happened. Was this a case of a disappearance or really foul play? And the Turks, I think, have been keen to get international support on this because everyone knows Saudi Arabia is a very powerful and rich nation, especially in the Muslim world. And so everybody has been looking, certainly from here, from Istanbul, where I'm based, has been looking to the American reaction. And we saw a couple of comments from President Trump, but also from Vice President Pence. And I think, importantly, more and more comments coming out from congressmen and senators. So the American, I think, side is waking up and taking this more seriously as the information is coming out and it's becoming more and more clear what happened.
This is a moment in which the United States has made, you know, at least the president has pulled no punches in his disdain, I think, for many in the press. And that attack on press freedoms has actually, I think, extended worldwide. We've seen a number of journalists killed in Mexico. We've seen a number of journalists killed in the EU recently. How do we know who we can trust with these stories, Carlotta? Are there any of the actors involved in this Khashoggi story that you feel are telling the truth, are not telling the truth? It just feels really difficult with these types of pieces to understand where to look.
It is difficult, and not least in Turkey, where not only, you know, the president of the USA criticized journalists, but the president of Turkey often criticizes journalists, including foreign journalists like me working here. But this is a completely different league from, you know, complaining about the press or banning press from working, or even here as journalists are put in prison. This is altogether a different league because it's not only an act against a journalist who was clearly disliked by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for his criticisms, but to dispose of him, breaking international law in another country, possibly disposing of him in the country or taking him out of the country. I mean, it's completely a different league of what we have seen from coming from the US president and the Turkish president. So it's also really shocked the Turks here, both in government and in society. I think the government are really appalled because they knew Jamal Khashoggi well. He counted among his friends people who are senior advisors in the government. He had a great reputation because he'd been reporting for 30 years on Middle East and Muslim affairs. And so he was well known and well respected. And for him to end up like this is appalling to a country that considered him a Muslim brother and who pride themselves on their hospitality and openness to guests. So it's shocked people across the board.
Carlotta Gall is the Istanbul Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Carlotta, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
As Democrats seek to wrestle back control of Congress this November, they're trying to mobilize a key part of their constituency, Black women. But are they really doing enough? Well, let's talk about it. In the 2016 presidential election, 94% of Black women voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, according to exit polls. And last year's Senate race in Alabama saw Black women prove pivotal in electing the state's first Democratic senator in a quarter century.
And we know that victory would never have happened without the organizing power down there, and without African American women, the backbone of the Democratic Party, 98% of whom voted for Doug Jones.
That's DNC Chairman Tom Perez. But some black female leaders are concerned that they aren't being given enough of a voice to shape the party's direction at its highest levels.
When you think of currently, right now, the spokespeople for the Democratic Party, I'm pretty sure there's not one woman of color who is speaking on behalf of the DNC, and I find that to be close to malpractice when you have so many black women around the country who support and make it possible for Democratic candidates to win when they don't see themselves in the leadership of the party. I think that that's a big strategic mistake.
That's Jamu Green. She's the founding member of Vote Run Lead, and she was the only black female candidate to run for DNC chair in 2017. She's become increasingly frustrated with the party's leadership.
And certainly with the Democratic National Committee. And as this was becoming more apparent, it was absolutely necessary for me to tell my personal story of why I ghosted the DNC when I noticed that there were a lot of systemic issues not being addressed as far as opportunities for black women in leadership positions at the National Party.
I'm wondering, we knew in the 2016 election that the majority of black women, 90-some-odd percent of black women, voted for Hillary Clinton. Was there any frustration in the women that you talked to about that, about their support of the Democratic Party in record numbers and then not the support that you're describing?
There's a lot of frustration out there. There's frustration in the Democratic Party's response to the 2016 election, where you had an overwhelming majority, upper 90% of African-American women voting for Hillary Clinton, voting for Democratic candidates, and not having the narrative that came out of the 2016 election really to recognize that. And the narrative that did come out of the 2016 election from many Democrats and from many of the Democratic Party institutions was focused around how the party needed to invest in white male voters. And as you can imagine, you know, that sparked frustration. I think also for me personally, watching the DNC chair race take off and not have any woman of color on that stage in those forums when everyone, and it's a very well-known phrase, says that women or black women are the backbone of the Democratic Party, but it's not reflected in the leadership selection, in the investments to recruit and train and support black women running for office. I mean, even today, I don't think those frustrations have been addressed in any real significant way from our party institutions when you have 4 out of the 84 targeted races for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, only 4 out of 84 are black women, given those numbers of support coming from black women to Democratic candidates, that's just not acceptable.
You, of course, ran for chair of the DNC. Could someone say, well, you're just frustrated that you didn't get the chair, and that's the basis of your critique? I have to ask the question, Jamu.
There couldn't be anything further from the truth. I think my entire professional political career has been focused on really amplifying the voices of disenfranchised and vulnerable communities. And I've always made it very clear that my work in politics has very little to do with me as an individual and everything to do with communities that need a greater voice, greater representation. Everything that I'm focused on right now is how we can correct the strategic mistakes that have been made in amplifying black women's voices within the Democratic Party.
So the interesting thing is you, in your piece, you've written about this process with, you know, trying to work with the DNC. And you said that Chairman Tom Perez and his deputy Keith Ellison, who, by the way, are both men of color, made decisions on the future direction of the party without really getting input from other folks. What would you like for the DNC to do with its current leadership?
Certainly, I think it's great that we have men of color in leadership positions within the Democratic Party. That's a good thing, and it should continue. It's just when you look at the numbers of votes that Democrats get from Black women, and you look at the activists behind the scenes who have been, you know, doing the bulk of the work for our candidates and for our institutions, the leadership doesn't reflect that same perspective. And I would hope that you could have men of color like Chairman Perez, like Deputy Chair Congressman Ellison, recognize that it's a problem and proactively, not in reaction to critique, but proactively say we need to do more. We can do better as a party.
There is a DNC initiative that was launched over the summer called Seat at the Table. And it's one of these, I guess, initiatives that was sent to really try to rebuild and train Black women to enter into the DNC. Do you think that that's enough? What's your sense of what Seat at the Table is doing?
The DNC should be on the forefront of putting opportunities on the table. And the Seat at the Table initiative is great. The more that can be done, the better. It's not something that is revolutionary. It's not something that is, you know, even relatively new to have events where you talk about Black women and their importance to the Democratic Party. We have to get past events. We have to go into a very strategic reckoning around how are we as a party recruiting Black women to run for office? How are we as a party redefining viability? I think that is a serious question that needs to be answered, because when you talk to the political operatives at the party institutions, specifically the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, you know, they're very focused on viability. The ability for a candidate to raise money is unfortunately the number one indicator of viability in a race. We have to change the definition of viability to allow for more Black women to get into the pipeline of running for office and running as Democrats. The last thing the Democratic Party can afford is for Black women to stay home on any election day, in any zip code, in any state, in any place in this country.
Jamu Green is a founding member of Vote Run Lead, an organization training women to run for public office. Jamu, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Artificial intelligence is really just a sophisticated way of saying algorithm.
AI is all the rage these days, and it's even taking over the hiring process.
Essentially, what recruiters are trying to do is understand the huge swaths of data that they have on potential candidates in an instant and drive recommendations for who they should hire, who they should interview, and what kinds of people they should be looking for in the way forward.
That's Dipayan Ghosh, a fellow at the Shorenstein Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. He was also a technology and economic advisor in the Obama White House and more recently worked on privacy policy issues at Facebook. As artificial intelligence, or AI, becomes a more common way of finding and screening job candidates, people like Ghosh are raising some red flags. But first, let's talk about the basics. What kinds of data are these algorithms using, and where are they getting it? Ghosh explains.
Data doesn't really have much regulation on it. That's where we have to start. And so what that means is that recruiters can really try to pull data from whatever sources are publicly available and privately available. Now, there are certain laws they have to respect, civil rights laws, for example, but for the most part, they can try to get data from anywhere. This could be from social media. It could be from the broader internet. It could be from data brokers. It could be from former employers. There are all sorts of sources. And when they're able to get more and more information about a particular candidate and drive the development of inferences about that candidate's behaviors and interests through analysis of that data using AI, they can really save some cost in the recruitment process and develop recommendations for candidates that can really do the specialized job in the most effective manner.
And let's talk about the bias that could show up initially, and we've seen the research on this for decades now, that people who have quote-unquote black-sounding names or ethnic-sounding names, for example, depending on what they are, may not get hired, and people who don't are more likely to get the interview. How does that play out in hiring? What's the positive here for using an algorithm if I'm a hiring manager, and what's the drawback?
Yeah, well, Tanzina, I think there is a lot of economic value in this kind of technology because it can cut time costs. The problem is that algorithms, and especially artificial intelligence algorithms, can often exacerbate and perpetuate biases. Because when you are basing your inferences about a set of resumes based on historical data, you can absolutely be furthering the idea that certain candidates are just not good for this company. So, for example, if we are looking at a big bulge bracket bank, perhaps historically their highest performing candidates have looked a particular way, been a certain race, been a certain gender, had a certain level of educational attainment from a certain small set of universities. And if they train their algorithm based on that historical information, then the algorithm is going to think that, hey, it's those candidates that I have to look for, and let's cut out the rest. And so what that means is that we can have huge discriminatory effects against everybody else that deserves for their resume to be looked at, but who don't fit this historical profile and who are essentially being discriminated against. And that is actually illegal. And the problem is that these algorithms are proprietary and private, and it's hard for us to have that level of transparency.
But how much of that is I mean, there's the vendor secret sauce, there's the algorithm that they've created, but then there's also my privacy.
Absolutely.
How do those things reconcile?
Up until now, it just doesn't reconcile. And that's the problem that we have. A lot of people don't necessarily want their information to be grabbed by recruiters, whether it's a vendor or a big company trying to look into you and determine whether or not you're a good candidate for a job at a bank or a job at Google or a job at any sort of multinational company. A lot of people just don't want their information to be pulled by these organizations and for their behavior and characteristics and personalities and routines and likes and dislikes and interests and preferences. Many of us don't want that to be on show for recruiters. How do we match that? There's not really a good solution for that. In the United States, we do not have a baseline privacy law. Europe does have a fundamental right to privacy. Europeans do. And many other countries and jurisdictions around the world are now trying to develop something similar. In the United States, we don't. And it's actually a bit of a non-starter here to give the individual, whether it's a voter or a consumer or any potential candidate for a job, it's a tough political battle to sell policymakers and politicians on the idea that privacy is something that deserves respect.
I know it because I covered it many years ago, particularly when there were many efforts in Washington, D.C. to try to pass some sort of policy legislation. And that was under the Obama administration, actually. Has your work at the Obama White House or at Facebook influenced how you look at this today?
Absolutely. While I was in the Obama White House, the Snowden disclosures had just happened. There was a lot of attention on the administration. There was a lot of pressure on America to do something about privacy, or in other words, do something about the breach of trust against Silicon Valley, really, and the American government in light of the tremendously challenging and extensive surveillance programs that America and the National Security Agency were engaging in. And part of our job was to craft a baseline privacy law, which we ultimately called the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, an idea crafted by a set of really brilliant minds in the Obama administration, both the first and second terms. And ultimately, the president announced that as a legislative draft, as a discussion draft for the consideration of the U.S. Congress, and released it publicly in early 2015. We released it late on a Friday night because we knew that it was going to be dead on arrival and fall on deaf ears, and was a non-starter at a political level.
So let's talk about where we go from here. Where do hiring managers go? Where do prospective employees go? Where does this, I feel like this technology has, because of a lack of privacy legislation and because of how fast this technology has moved, it almost seems like it's unstoppable.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do need policy change in this country. Let's just talk very briefly about where things are going to go if nothing is done, which is what many people anticipate. If nothing is done, the industry is going to continue to develop artificial intelligence, apply it to recruiting, and will not have any public interest auditing that happens. And so the discrimination problem is not necessarily going to be perpetuated, but very likely will be perpetuated because the public will have no leverage to understand how companies are using these algorithms and making their hiring decisions. That's what's going to happen. How do we move away from a world where we have this opacity in recruiting, which is such an important aspect of society? It's how we win our bread and how we pay for our rent. How do we have fairness in recruiting? Well, the public needs to understand that our data is an extension of ourselves, and it is extraordinarily valuable to corporate interests. It's extraordinarily valuable to foreign actors. It's extraordinarily valuable to almost any entity that might want to know anything about you. And knowing something about you is a tremendously powerful thing in the political context, in the hiring context, in the social media context, where our valuation of these companies has just skyrocketed. And until and unless the American public understands that and understands the value of data and the value of privacy and pushes our politicians for change, for policy change in this area that can really be meaningful and move Congress, nothing is going to happen.
Dipayan Ghosh is a fellow at the Shorenstein Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. Dipayan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yazoo City is a small rural town located in west central Mississippi. And while the town is roughly 87% Black, its school district is almost entirely segregated.
Segregation here in Yazoo City is still at a point, and it should not be. Our schools are 99.5 Black. And at 0.5 that is not Black is because the parent can't put them anywhere else in a private school. I think that shouldn't that be. Public schools should be a reflection of our city.
That's Carolyn Johnson, and she worked for nearly four decades as a fourth grade teacher and spent about 25 of those years in Yazoo City. In that time, she noticed glaring proficiency problems.
When I was teaching fourth grade, it was just too many that cannot read. Because if you can't read, you can't do math, you can't do anything.
And she says there was widespread instability.
What I'm seeing in our school and in public school is too high turnover. They're seeing sometimes before they can finish in one school year, they have gone through three or four teachers.
So after retiring from teaching, Johnson decided she wasn't done being an educator. This past July, she used her retirement money to open up a preschool in Yazoo City.
My dream here, Yazoo Gifted Academy, not just a place that you can bring your child to be babysit, but actually to learn how to read and how to be part of society.
Johnson is helping Yazoo City kids get into the right track before entering the public school system. But her preschool has only 22 children, so she's only reaching a fraction of Yazoo City's 2,400 public school students. And to help the poorest school district in the state of Mississippi, it's going to take a lot more than one teacher with a dream, especially in a town and a county with high poverty that shows no signs of letting up. Sarah Kleiner is a federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, and she recently traveled to Yazoo City as part of the Abandoned in America series that we've been highlighting all week.
The Yazoo City School District, the municipal school district there, is one of the worst in the state of Mississippi. And that's one of the reasons why we decided to go there, to talk to the people there, to find out how they feel about their education system, and to find out what can or is being done about it.
Now, you visited four of the district's public schools. Can you tell us or describe for our listeners a little bit about what you saw? What were the conditions like?
So a few of the schools are actually in very good shape. They are modern. There's new tables in the high school cafeteria, and those were in good shape. The oldest building in use by the district is Webster Elementary School, and this is for children who are just starting out. This is for pre-K, kindergarten, and first grade students. And the desks were marred from years of use. Their bathroom was partially out of order. There was peeling paint in the hallways, and you could tell that, you know, it had been repainted and repainted and repainted over and over again. This is the facility where the heating system had gone out a couple of years ago, and some parents tried to pay to have it fixed, tried to help the school district. And then the heating system couldn't keep up last winter, and one parent had to go and pick his child up early from school. So it's in rough shape, and the issue is that they don't have, there just isn't a tax base there. It's very low. They don't have a lot of income coming in, so they don't have resources to pour into this old facility.
Let's talk a little bit about race and how the demographics of these schools are playing into what you saw down there.
Sure. So what I found in my reporting is that in Mississippi, this has happened across the state. 49 of 145 school districts are more than three quarters African American. 19 districts are more than three quarters white. So the schools there have resegregated in a big way. And this is particularly true in Yazoo City, where in 1970, black students entered white schools for the first time. And there, after that period, white students started going to private school or they moved out to Yazoo County. And the school district there now is 98% black. And if you look across the state of Mississippi, none of the districts that are more than three quarters black are rated A or B. None of the districts that are more than three quarters white are rated D or F. So the gravity of the situation cannot be overstated.
Now, is that, you mentioned that's the tax base, but is that really the only reason why these schools are, where you're seeing the discrepancies in these schools? Is it only financial? What else is driving this?
So there's a lawsuit by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it was filed in 2017. It's on hold right now. Actually, a judge in Mississippi decided that the state of Mississippi couldn't be sued over this. But the lawsuit is against the state, and it says that it still has a separate and unequal school system, that there are differences between the quality of education. There is a difference between the quality of education that black students are receiving and the quality of education that white students are receiving. Teacher retention, quality of facilities, income plays into all of this.
Now, you spoke to the district's new superintendent, and that person's name is Georgia Ingram.
We have several challenges to face in the upcoming 18-19 year. Our challenges is to get community support, build our teacher morale, and to make sure that we increase student achievement and our teacher capacity throughout the district.
She's the district's third superintendent in 4 years, which indicates to me not just instability, but what's happening there?
It's definitely an unstable situation. And when a district gets poor marks year after year after year, it's very hard to retain a leader. But what, you know, the local folks were saying is that they need someone to stick around. They need someone to stay and implement a plan.
Sarah Kleiner is a federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can find a link to the Abandon in America project from the Center for Public Integrity at thetakeaway.org. Yesterday on the show, we talked about a new UN report that spells doom for the future of our planet. According to the report, the planet is quickly getting hotter, and we might be too late to do anything about it. And when it comes to what we can do to be better global citizens, lots of you called us with your advice and reactions.
My name is Amaka, and I'm calling from Orlando. We keep talking about as if we're doing something, and we're not doing one quarter of what we should be doing. Even things like making recycling mandatory, just make it mandatory everywhere to recycle. Don't even give us an option.
It's greed and want and overuse of finite resources that have created an incredibly big part of the problem.
Hey, this is Aaron in Philadelphia, and I voted green the last two big elections. I always vote Green Party. It's always my top concern, and I can't believe it isn't a bigger issue on the world stage.
This is Jason Folkman calling from San Diego, California. The easiest thing that we can all do today is simply to eat less meat and dairy.
This is Scott from Vashon Island in Washington State. And as much as I do believe in climate change, and as much as I do my best to have as small a carbon footprint as I can, I also believe that it's too late.
I sure hope it's not too late, and I appreciate you and everyone else who weighed in. You can share your thoughts, plus tell us what steps you take in your own life to mitigate the effects of climate change by tweeting us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. Hasta mañana.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.